Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 192. And at the end of last lesson, we were in Genesis 37, at the point where Joseph was looking for his brothers in Dothan. And so we read in verse 17, Genesis 37, when he was asking the man, "Did you see them?" And we mentioned the fact that the family of Jacob was very well known in the area, obviously. They've been there around for a while. And so when you ask someone about the family of Jacob, you know, they immediately could tell you. And this person happened to be one of those. And so when Joseph asked him about the location of his brothers, he knew exactly, because apparently he happened to just stop by and talk to them. And he overheard them saying that they were going to Dothan. And so we read in verse 18, "And they saw him afar off, and before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him." Now that was their intent, and basically there were two ringleaders here that wanted to bring this calamity upon him, and that was apparently Levi and Simeon, people, two brothers, who seem to have the nature of violence in them, unfortunately, and rushing to action. And that was seen already in the city of Shechem, the way they treated the city for what they've done. In other words, you can say about these people that it can be nice to you if you meet people like that from Simeon or Levi, but don't ever double-cross them, because if you do, they're the worst enemies that you can have. And so Joseph, from their point of view, double-crossed them, made them angry, and they were the kind of people that were quick to action. And you see that throughout their history, and even to this very day. And it is for that reason that later on Jacob was saying that he was going to scatter them, and, you know, being under inspiration by the Holy Spirit, by God, and that was the mind of God. He was going to scatter them throughout all the tribes of Israel. Not only Levi was for the purpose of teaching, but it is because of these qualities. When they are all in one place, it is a lot of problem. And if you know what the Simeonites are today and the Levites, and when you study their characters, you find them in all the tribes of Israel, in this country, in the United States, you find that basically you see them in the South. And you study their character, you see these traits there. Anyway, they're basically the ones that really wanted to do it, because later on in the conversation that they carried on in front of Joseph, not knowing that he was listening, he would notice that the ones that he put in prison was not all the brothers, but in particular the ones that he felt were the most vindictive about him. And so when he gets further down to the story, when they came down to Egypt, and they did not realize that Joseph understood what they were talking about, we see that at the end he took, all of them for 3 days, and he put them in prison. But when he released them, he took Simeon, the one that he felt was the most vindictive and the most ruthless. And obviously not only in terms of what happened earlier in Shechem, but in specific with him and his relationship with him. And apparently he must have been the one that hated him the most, and probably led his brothers to feel that way, even more so. And so he took Simeon and he put him in prison until the 12 sons, that is, you know, the brothers of Joseph, came back again the second time from Egypt. So Simeon was all this time in prison for quite a while all by himself. Anyway, so this is what we see here, that as soon as they saw him from a distance, they wanted to kill him. And that was their intent. And that was a conspiracy anyway. Verse 19, "And they said one to another, Behold, this dreamer comes. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him, and cast him into one of the pits, and we will say, An evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." I can imagine for them to get to that point, and they were very guilty, obviously, about it. And The reality is that there are different players here. First, God is working out all that, and he's using their emotions and their anger at him that caused them to come this far. And then also, Joseph needed to learn lessons. After all, he had a major part in bringing that about. And Jacob had a part in it because of his preference. And he was, esteeming one better than the others, and that was very bad for the family. It's always like that in families where there is such a thing. It causes always problems. And so God was going to teach, in essence, all of them lessons, beside the fact that he himself had a plan, and that was his intent, that Joseph end up there for future reasons. So many things come into play here. So when we read about what the brothers wanted to do, we have to realize that God is also inspiring and stirring their spirits. And he does it in different ways. Sometimes, we have some examples actually in the Bible, the way he does it, now and then. With David, for example, when he saw that Israel was sinning against him, even under the reign of David, he was very angry with them. And we read it in two accounts. In one account, in 1 Samuel, and then in 1 Chronicles. In one account we read in 1 Samuel that God was angry with Israel, and so he stirred David to number Israel, because he wanted to bring a punishment on them. And then another account in 1 Chronicles, I believe, we read that it was Satan who stirred David to number Israel. And it seems to be as a contradiction until you understand that God was the one stirring David through Satan. In other words, he allows him to do that, just like he did with Job, just like he did with him in the Garden of Eden. And so it's probably is the same here. And he's using all that to fulfill his purpose. And at the same time, he allows their emotions and all of them to learn lessons. And so this is what they say in verse 21. Then we read, and Reuben heard it and delivered him out of their hand. Now, he is the firstborn, so he prevails. In other words, he says, you are not going to do that. And he said, let us not take his life. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but lay no hand upon him, that he might deliver him out of their hand to restore him to his father. In other words, he was in essence conspiring in the positive way. He was going to prevent them from killing him, and while they are busy with the sheep, he was planning to actually go down there, pick him out of the ditch, or get him out one way or the other, hide him somehow, and then let him flee and go back to his father. And so that was his intent. So you can see here the different players. Reuben never wanted that. He was the firstborn, yes, and Joseph is having here the preeminence. And yet Reuben was the one that, in essence, made possible for Joseph to remain alive. Well, the others were more in favor of that. And then, that's not the end of the plot here. And then we read in verse 23, and it came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren. Now, all this time, all these things are going on, and Joseph is not there yet. They are just conspiring. And God is recording all these things. Obviously, he was there. He saw it. He was involved in it. He's a part of it. And so he's dictating it to Moses. That knows exactly what's going on there. And it came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph of his coat, the coat of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into the pit, and it was empty. So it was not dangerous there. They just were going to put him there until they decide what to do with him next. And so they put him into the empty pit, and there was no water in it, and they sat down to eat bread. Now, poor Joseph is down there, and they're just sitting down and eating bread. So you can imagine that they were not in the right state of mind to get to that point and to behave in that manner toward their brother. I mean, he can have his own crazy dreams, you might think. That's no reason to kill someone. So obviously there is more than just the human reaction there. God is involved in the process. And he's probably using the devil to inject this spirit of murder in them and anger, you know, and they lose their sanity in that sense by doing that. And nevertheless, in all that, God is involved. And of course, when we do not know the mind of God, when we do not see the entirety of the picture, we look at it humanly speaking, and we do that with many, many other things, and we think there is something wrong with God. The God that said that I create evil, you see, and I bring good. So he's responsible for all, because there is a plan that is working out here below. It involves all these things. And it is for this very reason also that he allows the devil to continue to reign on this earth, and he allowed him for the, you know, for 6,000 years. And people don't understand that. They think, well, if God is love, well, how come? Well, it's because God is love that those things are happening for the benefit of us all. Now, while we go through it, doesn't seem to be that way. But then the picture is not over. The scene, you know, the movie is not over, so to speak. And at the end of time, when we see all these things, just like Job, when he finally saw and understood the purpose of it all, of everything that came upon him, and he was not guilty in his case, then he recognized the authority and the prerogative of God to do with his creation and to work out his plan in whichever way he chooses. And it's not up to men to gainsay him. You know, as Paul would say, now, who are you to gainsay God, in essence, when he's discussing the issue of Pharaoh? Some people will say, well, you know, Pharaoh had no choice, you know, God hardened his heart, you know, he couldn't do anything about it. And in essence, people, you know, point the finger at God. And so we see a similar case here, where humanists, so to speak, people who have no faith or people do not understand God, they look at this case and they say there is something wrong with God, that he allowed all that. And Joseph at this point obviously is very distraught, he's very angry, he's very mad, he's very unhappy, very frustrated and all that, and he surely has very bad feelings. And he wonders, so how come he's not being delivered, why God is not with him? And it's only at the end of the road, when he learned the whole thing, when he learned the matter for what it really is, then he understood that it was of God, and he thanked God for it, and he told his brothers that you did not really do it. Ultimately speaking, God was the one really behind it, even though you had those feelings of animosities against me. But God was working out his plan, and that's exactly what happens with the heart and the mind of a servant of God. He gets finally to the point where he says, thy will be done. You see, not my will, but your will, even though it's different than what I think it should be. And that's the way it is, and that's exactly what the Savior, Jesus Christ, the Creator, the very one here who is involved, that's what he said when he had to go through that himself, and then he pleaded with the Father, and then he realized, no, that's the way it is, and he said, your will be done, even though he himself would have rather have it differently at the moment. So that's, you know, one way, as we study the law, we learn many lessons, and this is exactly what is happening here. Well, Joseph is in that condition, in that terrible calamity and predicament that came upon him. And you can imagine what he's going through, what goes on through his mind and his heart. Here are the brothers who just sit down and eat bread. And they lifted up their eyes while they were eating bread, obviously, and looked, and behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites. So these were Ishmaelites, and they came from Gilead. Who are the Ishmaelites? Well, we all know, children of Ishmael. And mind you, Ishmael, who was the son of Abraham, married an Egyptian woman from Egypt. In other words, his mother took an Egyptian woman. And so the descendants that he had were, in essence, related to Abraham on one side and still Egyptians on the other. And that's why later on Ishmael ended with the main country of Ishmael to this very day is Egypt. And then obviously he went also to other areas. And you can imagine that his wife was an Egyptian, and his children are half Egyptian and half from Abraham. Actually, by now he has less than that, you know, then probably he married another Egyptian. And pretty soon, you know, they all become Egyptian. They just have that lineage, that DNA from Father Abraham. Some qualities from Abraham, but, you know, biologically speaking, most of them became later on, just like they used to be before, Egyptians. And so, these Ishmaelites, they became traitors, They were not men of the field. They were men of cattle. Men of the desert. They were nomads, and they were merchants because of that also, and they were carrying all these goods that generally were traveling, as it said later on, earlier. But Ishmael, when he grew up, he dwelt all along his brethren. In other words, he would be traveling and also residing all the way from Egypt to the Euphrates, Mesopotamia, Babylon, through Syria. And that became his trade and his way of life. So they became sort of nomads, merchants, and people of the desert. And so they were coming here from Gilead, which is, obviously Moses is writing here this matter, and there was no Gilead at the time. There was Galed, that was a pile of stone that, remember, Jacob and Laban, when they separated from each other, that's what they did there, but it was not a city, it was just a pile of stones at the time. But as time went by, you know, it became a city and a territory. That's where Manasseh was later on. And so they came from that area. They were trading, in other words, with different countries, different peoples, different tribes. And they came down with their camels bearing spices and balm and ladanum, in other words, all the things that they were buying, and were bringing it down to Egypt. So they were going down to carry it down to Egypt. And verse 26, now we read another twist here of the story. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? In other words, they still had the intent of doing it, even though Reuben temporarily stopped him from doing it immediately as soon as he arrived, that is Joseph. And so his fate was still hanging in the balance, and the brothers were still intent on carrying on their desire, that is, to destroy and to kill Joseph. And so now Judah intervenes, and you can imagine what the conversation was about as they were eating. And so he thinks, and some people do not understand that, especially the people that have anti-Semitic feelings, they think, well, Judah, all he cares about is profits. That was not the intent. That was on the mind of Judah. Let's be honest about it and read it for what it says. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? That was the intent. You see, what value is it? We're not talking about money, profit. You see? What is the value of killing our brother and concealing his blood? There is no value in that. You see? We're not getting anything by that. It's just going to be make matters worse for the family, you know, for our father. And so, in essence, he's conspiring here because the brothers are intent on killing his brother Joseph. He's conspiring here, in essence, just like Reuben was conspiring to try to, get them forget about the plan of killing him, and then when he has a chance, he'll get him out there and let him loose. And Judah, on the other hand, came up with a better plan. And that is, he said, let's sell him. Because they knew that if that would not happen, they would really go ahead and kill him. And Reuben would not be able to save him. And so he says, come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. And let not our hand be upon him. For he is our brother, our flesh. You see? That was the intent on the part of Judah. It was a very noble gesture on his part. And it's not, as some people, you know, have wrong feelings and emotions about Judah. They think, well, all they're caring about is just profit, money. He was going to make some money out of it. And that's very, very despicable to even think that way. And later on you will see when we come to this point, when Judah is speaking to Joseph about that, and you read, you know, you will go through his speech and the words that was really on the mind and on the heart of Judah and what he was willing to do also. In contrast to what even Reuben was willing to do. When we read the Word of God, you know, it's very important for us to read it with pure minds and hearts, not with bigotry and or animosity and hatred or malice or whatever it may be, which unfortunately some, as they read the Bible, especially in specific with Judah, be it here or later on in the New Testament, their heart is so full of darkness, all they can see is just evil. And so, this is what he's saying in verse 27, come let us and sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother. He was reminding them, we shouldn't be killing him. He is our flesh. You know, in spite of all the feelings that we may have toward him, may be angry at him, but let's remember who that person is. And so that, in essence, changed their mind and bridled, you know, their venomous emotions at this time and desire to kill him, and their hatred and vengeful, you know, feelings. And so he prevailed upon them, and in that way he was doing two things. First, he was protecting the life of Joseph. He preserved his life. He prevented his brothers from killing him. And then he was fulfilling the plan of God. It was a part of the plan of God. So you can see here also God involved in the whole process. And verse 28, and there passed by Midianites merchantmen. Now, while they're sitting there eating, discussing these matters about Joseph, he's, you know, in a pit, a distance away from them. They don't necessarily sit right there by the pit and discussing these matters. And so while they're doing it, first is the Ishmaelites are coming, and so they're, you know, Judah is proposing this, and apparently the brothers, obviously, agree to it. And then while they're going through this process, also Midianites, and Midianites were, you see, Ishmael were from Abraham, directly from Ishmael, the Ishmaelites, while the Midianites were the children of the son of Abraham from Keturah, and not from Hagar. And so, these are related. As a matter of fact, all of these people are related to each other, through Father Abraham. And so while the Ishmaelites were approaching on their camels, a group of Midianites happened to walk by, and they apparently heard somebody screaming in a pit, so they looked down there, and they see a young man there, so they pick him up, and they saw the Ishmaelites coming, and they were not interested, you know, in this one, but they were interested in making a little money, and so they sold into the Ishmaelites, and all the brothers were totally unaware of what's happening in the meantime. So you can see also the way that it worked out. They intended to do selling, that is, they intended first to kill him, they intended first to sell him, after that to sell him. They didn't get to do any of that. God worked it out in such a way that the Midianites were the ones who pulled him out and sold him to the Ishmaelites, and the Ishmaelites were gone. And so by the time they go back to Joseph, he's no more there. And they didn't know what happened to him. And so this is what happens here. And you can see the intricacy here of the plan, the way God was working it out. And so they're passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Actually, the slaves at the time were basically about 30 pieces of silver, but apparently Joseph still looked like a young boy. He wasn't worth as much. The way they thought about it, you know, just a kid. And so they get 20 silvers for them. And so all these things are happening while the brothers of Joseph are still discussing the matter over lunch. And so they brought Joseph into Egypt, that is the Ishmaelites. Now we read about Reuben, what's happening in verse 29. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and obviously his brothers also with him. But he in specific is the one that wants to go there and let him loose. And so he goes back there, the first. And he looks down there, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. Now, all the brothers were all sitting together, so he knew that none of them had done anything to him. And obviously, Joseph on his own could not flee from that pit, you know, unless somebody let him loose. And he couldn't understand what was happening. And so he rent his clothes. And he returned unto his brothers and said, the child is not. And as for me, whither shall I go? In other words, I am the firstborn. I am responsible, you know. And before my father, he will hold me responsible. And he was really shocked at this point. And so he rent his clothes. That's something that you do at a very extreme case. A death of a person. And a horrible calamity. And the high priest was not supposed to do it, but he did it when he felt that Jesus was blaspheming, calling God his father, and he rent his clothes. You know, in other words, extreme cases, that's when people do that. Or Tamar, you know, when she was raped by her own brother, half-brother, she rent her clothes. In other words, people do that at extreme cases, and that's exactly what Reuben was doing here. And he didn't know what happened to him, and so that's the way he reacted. And so here in verse 30 he says, and he returned unto his brethren and said, so you can see the situation here, they're still there eating lunch, and he's the one sneaking, you know, pretending like he's going to do something, and sneaking back there trying to release Joseph, and Joseph is gone. And so it goes back to the brothers, who are totally unaware of what's happening. Now they have their intents, they have their feelings, they have their desires, they have their plans and conspiracy, but they are not able to carry any of it. It was just only in their mind and in their heart. And the reality is, as God will tell us later on, and as he came in the flesh, in the person of Jesus Christ, he said that not only if you murder your brother that you are guilty, you know, but also if you just think about it, if you are hating your brother, if you are angry with your brother, that's good enough to find you guilty also. So they were guilty of the death, which they thought, of their brother, or whatever happened to him, even though they didn't do it. And because of that hatred, that also already made them murderers in that sense, from the point of view of God. And so he goes back to his brothers and he said, the child is not, and as for me, whither shall I go? And so now they devise a plan, you know, what are we going to do? And so they took Joseph's coat and killed a he-goat and dipped the coat in the blood, and they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father. So they're trying to deflect any guilt from themselves. And they said, this have we found. Know now whether it is your son's coat or not. Well, obviously, they knew that it was. He knew that it was. But they're presenting it in such a way as if they're not guilty about it. But God knew what was happening here. From God's point of view, they were guilty of what they've done. Jacob is not aware of it yet later on. And he's going to find out. And in the meantime, the plan of God is being carried on in spite of men. And that's the way it happens also in our own lives. And so when we study the law of God and we see all these examples and the way God works out matters, that should give us a little bit more understanding of the mind of God and of the nature of God, and therefore also monitor our own emotions and feelings and actions, because God is going to use them one way or the other to fulfill his purpose and his plan. And so Jacob rent his garments. For him, that meant, you know, death, the death of Joseph, and he put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. Generally, the period of mourning is about 30 days. First, you know, for 7 days, they sit around the dead, and then, in other words, special mourning ceremony that lasts about 7 days and still does to this very day in the Middle East, in the Jewish community. And then for 30 days, they mourn, and then they have a period of about a year where they have a ribbon, a black ribbon, you know, they put on their arm, and for 30 days, the first 30 days, they do not shave, and some, you know, for a whole year, they do not shave their beard. And that's a sign of a mourner. But he, in his case, went many days, and his many days actually lasted until he saw Joseph again. That's a period of 21 years. And you can see, you know, how everyone involved in this plot, one way or the other, was paying the penalty, and God was teaching a lesson to every one of them in particular. And so he does to all of us too. That's why Christ told us, and he warned us, you know, by every word that proceeds out of your mouth, you are going to be judged. And the judgment oftentimes comes also not only in the life to come, but in this life. And so we have to be very careful in every of words that we speak, of emotions and feelings that we express, because God, since he loves us, he's going to root it out of us one way or the other. And therefore, we should be mindful as we study the law, that's the way the mind of God works. In verse 35, and so we read that he's been mourning for his sons for many days, and all his sons and all his daughters, daughters means, you know, he had only one daughter, Dinah, but you know, all the other daughters that came from his sons, that is his granddaughters, rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, nay, but I will go down to the grave to my son mourning. So he said, I'm going to mourn until the day I die, which is extremely unusual. But then again, you can imagine Jacob thinking about the fact that he himself was responsible also for bringing this calamity. And not that he knew that his sons had done it, but he realized that he sent him over there, and the tension that was among them, and the fact that he allowed Joseph to be in a position that he may have thought maybe God punished him for his attitude, whatever it may be. We don't know what was going on through his mind. All we know is that everybody was being tormented for this very thing, which ironically, you know, in terms of the doing, they conspired, yes, they felt that way, they were going to do it, but they haven't done anything, and it happened anyway. So nobody was here in control, but God was in absolute control of everything from A to Z. And so he said he was going to mourn for the rest of his life, and his father wept for him. And you can imagine that he kept doing it for a long, long time. In the meantime, we read, and the Midianites, in verse 36, sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's, the captain of the guard. Now, earlier we were reading that it was the Midianites that sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites, and the Ishmaelites actually were the ones that took him down to Egypt. Well, here the account says that it was the Midianites, and in Hebrew it doesn't say Midian, it says Medanim. And Medan, generally a word that means men of strife. So probably, it's, you know, obviously it could not be the Midianites, since they sold it to the Ishmaelites. And why exactly it says Midianites here, or Medanim in Hebrew, not Midianim. Midianim means Midianite, and Medanim means men of strife. But it could be that since they are the ones that were responsible for selling him, therefore the account here records them as being responsible for doing it, even though they personally haven't done it, just like personally the brothers of Joseph haven't sold him or haven't killed him, and yet they're guilty of it, and so the Midianites in that sense also are guilty of that. And maybe that's the reason why it is written in that way. Anyway, they sold him to Egypt, and into Potiphar, and Potiphar was a general, and in that sense he was in the court, a high official. Potiphar means the gift of Ra, and Ra was the Egyptian sun god. That was his name, Potiphar, and he was the captain of the guard, sort of a general in today's terminology. And it came to pass at that time, we read in chapter 38, verse 1, that Judah went down. Now there is an instant story here, you know, as time went by, you know, Joseph is now there in Egypt. God now is switching to another subject, just like you find in a movie, you know, something goes on and then suddenly it goes to another scene and told a different story that seems to be unrelated. And so that's the way God recorded it here. And it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned in to a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira, and Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua, and he took her and went in unto her. In other words, for whatever reason, Judah was not able to find a wife from his entourage, that is, from the company of his father, or maybe he just didn't like anyone there. And so as he was going, you know, with the sheep into the field, he saw this young girl, he fell in love with her, and she was a Canaanite, and so he took her, and she became his wife. And so in essence, the people of Judah were from two races, you might say, a Canaanite, which is a Hamitic race, and also from Judah, who obviously is a Semite, and you find some other of the brothers that did the same. Later on, you know, they married among their own family, and so it's not that the Jews come from two races. It just, you know, there was an interjection there of a Canaanite. After all, later on there was Ruth the Moabite, and she was a Moabite, but, you know, a relative of Abraham. And then there was Rahab that married one of the spies, and she was in the lineage of Jesus Christ. And then you find with Moses, you know, he was marrying an Ethiopian, and you find also with Joseph himself, who married an Egyptian woman. So there wasn't any total purity there in the family. And it is for that reason, and also the fact that whenever, according to the law, whenever they went to war against the people from faraway places, and even nearby places later on, once they killed all the male, as they've done earlier, as we read in the story of Shechem, they killed every male there, but they've taken the women, they've taken, you know, that is the young women, that was a custom, and injected that element into their family. And so the family of Israel, the family of Abraham, was not totally pure. There were always a mixture there of two races. You know, the third one was far away, that is Japheth. But at least with the tribe, with the local natives and the nations around, there was a measure, not a great one, obviously. And then when they went in Egypt also, there were some intermarriage there with Egyptians and so forth, and I'm sure with the Philistines later on and other peoples. So you see the attitude in the Jewish community, in the community of Israel, that is totally different than you find in, let's say, the United States 100 years ago, 50 years ago, where there is that feeling that a white should never marry a black because, you know, that's contrary to the law, and people use laws of God, you know, where you don't mix this and that, you know, cotton and something else, which is basically a product of bigotry and animosity, you know, and feelings and emotions that are misguided in that sense. Yes, God generally wants people to marry within their own family, within their own people, within their own tribe. All that is true. But on the other hand, there was never any attitude in the Bible, negative attitude toward a mixed race or a mixed marriage. Generally, they haven't done it anyway because the parents would choose someone from the family, so that took care of the matter. So it was never an issue, biblically speaking. And unfortunately, people, when they inject their own emotions and feelings and bigotry, you know, and other things like that, then they supposedly go into the Bible to find out, an alibi, you know, for their feelings. Well, I think we should learn to be above that, because obviously, from the beginning of the family of Abraham, there was a mixture there, and even the very lineage of Jesus Christ himself had a Canaanite there and a Moabite there and who knows how many others. And so we should think more from that point of view. So on one hand, we realize, yes, God wants us to stick together closer to the family, people of the same nature, of the same mind, of the same character. But on the other hand, if there are some cases among us, and obviously we have that, that are not that way. Let's remember Moses and Abraham and Jesus Christ and all the others, and that has never been an issue here. So this is basically where we find Judah here. It was not an issue, even though as a family, before that, Abraham made sure, you go back to my family and bring a wife. Isaac said to Jacob, you go back to my family and bring a wife. Esau didn't do it. He married Canaanites. And they didn't like it, but you have to understand, if the Canaanite is totally, totally following the religion of her husband, that's one thing. But if she's going to bring idolatry, and that was the issue in the Bible, it was not mixed races. That was the issue in the Bible, but God made it very plain. It's the issue of idolatry, and that's the reason why he forbid them to marry others. But if they're going to obey the religion of the father, of the husband, of the family, of the people, well, there is no problem there. And that was the only issue there. So even in see that Paul is telling us, you know, you do not marry somebody who is unequally yoked. Now, she may be of your own family too. You see, but if she's going to bring her idol worship, they shouldn't do that. So again, there it's not an issue of races, it's an issue of idolatry. Serving God or serving other gods and creating confusion in Babylon in the family. So this is what you find here. He marries a Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went in unto her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er, or air, and in Hebrew means alive, awake. And she conceived again and bore a son, and he called his name Onan. And she yet again bore a son and called his name Shelach. Shelach means sent. And Onan comes from On, which means strength. That's where the name Benjamin came from. His mother, Rachel, called him Ben-Oni, the son of my strength. And Jacob changed his name to Binyamin, the sons of my right. And verse 6, we read, and Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. And Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord. We don't know why and what he did. And the Lord slew him. How he did it? Well, maybe through sickness, maybe through another mean, whatever it may be. God was responsible for the fact that this person died. In verse 8, and Judah said unto Onan, go in unto your brother's wife, and perform the duty of the husband's brother unto her. So you can see that this law, that later on became also a part of the codified law, was not something new. It was actually something that was very much practiced by all the Semitic people there, all the people in the Middle East, in the cradle of society, and as they travel abroad to other countries, they've taken it with them, and that became a part of the law of God also. To begin with, it was a part of the law of God, apparently, from the beginning, when this became a reality in the lives of the children of Adam and Eve. And so, this is what Judah says, you go do that, and raise to your seed a brother, because it was important that the brother will have a name to survive him. And verse 9, and Onan knew that the seed would not be his, and it came to pass, when he went into his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground, and you know what it means, lest he should give seed to his brother. And the thing which he did was evil in the sight of the Lord. You see, that's a part of the law of God. That's caring for your brother. That has an awful lot to do with the law of God and the nature of God and the mind of God and the importance of someone having his seed continue. You see, and therefore God was very furious and angry with it. It was totally selfish on the part of his brother. And so he killed him too. And verse 11, then said Judah to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grow up. And for he said, lest he also die like his brothers. In other words, he was in essence telling her that when the third one will grow older, then I will give him to you. But in reality, he did not really intend to do it. And so Tamar had to do something about it later on. And he was going, you know, he was deceitful about it in this sense with her, and she was going to outwit him, and she did, as we shall read later. And so Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house, in verse 11, and then verse 12, and in the process of time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. So that was her name, Shua. She was the daughter of Shua, but, you know, her name is not given there. But she's called Shua's daughter. And Judah was comforted and went up unto his sheep shearers to Timnah. And Timnah later on became a part of the tribe of Dan, so that was near the Philistines. And he and his friend Hira the Adullamite, who was a Canaanite, not among, you know, from the family, and it was told Tamar, saying, behold, your father-in-law goes up to Timnah to share his sheep, and she put off from her garments, that is, she put off from her the garments of her widowhood, and people are still doing it to this very day in many parts of the Middle East and the Balkan countries. When they become widows, they put on a widow's garment, and everybody knows when they see them, that's a widow, and they can treat them properly in that manner, or appropriately. And so she took off her widowhood garments, and she's still a young woman at this point, and she covered herself with her veil, and wrapped herself, in other words, she attired herself, and she looked obviously not like herself. She wanted to deceive him. And she sat in the entrance of Enaim, which is by the way to Timnah. So she knew he was going to pass by, and she was going to trip him, pretending to be, in essence, a harlot. And so the reason why she did it says here, because she saw that Shelah was grown, in other words, he was an older man already, ready for marriage, and yet she realized that her father-in-law was deceiving her about Shelah. And obviously, from his point of view, he was afraid that these two will die. And, you know, he had only three sons. That's a little bit too much for him. And so she was not given unto him to wife. And when Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot, for she had covered her face. And he turned unto her by the way and said, "Come, I pray thee, let me come in unto you," for he knew now that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come in unto me?" In other words, you've got to pay for it. And he said, "I will send you a kid." In other words, he had nothing with him. And that's the reason why she asked him. What are you going to, you know, he had no money on him. So obviously there was a conversation going on there. And he said, "I will send a kid of the goats from the flock." And she said, "Will you give me a pledge?" Well, anyway, I think we're going to stop at this point and continue next time. And this is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.